My name is Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. It's so good to be with you today and every day. Now, over the weekend, New York shared data showing that multiple cases of the Omicron variant, now up to at least 12, have been detected in New York. Then on Monday,
we in New York City have decided to use a preemptive strike. As of today, we're going to announce a first-in-the-nation measure. Our health commissioner will announce a vaccine mandate for private sector employers across the board. All private sector employers in New York City will be covered by this vaccine mandate as of December 27th.
Now, that's outgoing New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And it's worth noting that right now, about 70% of New York City is fully vaccinated. That's much higher than the 60% U.S. rate. So vaccinations might not be a pervasive issue in New York City, but the mandate could influence other cities or states across the country to follow in its footsteps. And that, of course, could prompt backlash. In early November, 11 states filed lawsuit against the Biden administration for trying to impose a vaccine mandate similar to the one New York City just announced. And last week, a federal judge halted Biden's vaccine mandate for U.S. healthcare workers. Undoubtedly, partisanship explains much of the national division surrounding vaccine mandates. But this divide may highlight another important policymaking challenge: the contemporary American reluctance to contribute to the public good. I mean, maybe now is an appropriate time to ask
not what your country can do for you,
but what can we do for our country? With me now is Greg Gonsalves, who is public health correspondent for The Nation, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership, and associate professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
Resistance to vaccine mandates is not a uniquely American phenomenon. We've seen it in parts of Europe as well.
It is and it isn't, because a lot of the sort of anti-vax movement is an American export. Yes, there are homegrown sort of resistance to vaccine mandates, not just in the U.S., but the movement, anti-vax movement, is global, and it's also coming from the same sort of ilk of politicians across the Atlantic as we see here in the United States.
So it's like the gap. We created and exported it all over the world.
Yes, sadly.
Okay, yeah, on many levels. So I've been wondering about if part of the challenge here is it's just the language of public, or even thinking or framing this in a public sense. I mean, Greg, I don't want to go like too far into this metaphor, but I just was thinking about, you know, victory gardens in the context of World War II, and the notion that when the nation was faced with a national crisis, the federal government could call on ordinary Americans to make sacrifices and contributions to the war effort. But in this case, really from early on, both the federal government didn't seem to ask for those kinds of sacrifices. And when it did, when it asked for folks to get over their vaccine reluctance and get vaccinated, not only for themselves, but for others, man, the pushback was swift and highly individualized.
Well, first of all, we don't have to go back to World War II to think of examples of where people sort of line up for vaccination and do it willingly and don't think for a second about it. Anyone who has a child, or anyone who's been a child, so it means everyone, has gone to elementary school or junior high school or high school in the United States where mandatory vaccinations to get into school, measles, mumps, rubella, are done every day of every week of every year. We were pretty good at getting vaccinated in the U.S. for childhood diseases, and something happened with COVID-19 vaccines, which is really less about individual hesitancy than sort of using vaccines as a wedge issue for political gain. Even some of the politicians who are vociferously opposed to COVID mandates are now starting to talk about childhood preventable diseases. I mean, it's sort of astonishing to me that something that we sort of agreed on for decades and decades and decades is now being set up as in opposition to freedom and individual liberty when we didn't think 2 seconds about it before this pandemic.
You said in the Nation podcast that Republicans are describing Omicron as a Democratic plot to bring back mail-in voting. What?
It doesn't make any sense anymore, right? It doesn't make any sense on sort of the sort of logical basis. Nobody invented Omicron, you know, to have mail-in voting 5,000 miles away from where we've seen the variant emerge. And so there's nothing that the Democratic administrations can do at the state level or at the federal level that would not be sort of suspect in any way. This is less about where we were in World War II than a really contemporary conservative phenomenon, which we saw starting before Trump, but really, you know, flourishing last year. We're all tired of this pandemic. We're tired of mask wearing. We're tired of all the restrictions on us. But we don't get out of it unless we all band together for our collective good. And because this is a collective action problem, not about individual liberty or rights.
So the one reason I want to go back to that World War II moment and this kind of idea of collective sacrifice and the public good is my bet, and this is more of a hunch than something I have empirical evidence for, but my bet is that particularly white Americans understood the word public and the public good to represent something different in the 1940s than in the 1960s and thereafter. And that what intervenes in the middle is basically integration, or at least desegregation, and that we can map throughout the South, for example, that you stop seeing investments in public transportation. We can map that there's not another school, public school built in New Orleans, for example, after Brown v. Board until we get to Katrina. And I guess I'm wondering, like, if part of what we're living with in the COVID moment is actually about a 60-year-old legacy of disinvestment from the public sphere once the public was understood as more racially diverse.
If you want to take it in that direction, I completely agree with you 100%. I mean, basically, our whole public health history in the United States is based on exclusion, right? You can go way before World War II to post-Civil War era when an entire set of epidemics was ignored because they were happening to newly freed slaves rather than the white former slaveholders in the South. So we can go through American history and talk about how we sort of obscure public health because of who gets the disease, who doesn't get the disease. So the Victory Gardens and the Greatest Generation was constructed as entirely white. Once you start thinking about why we have a weak social safety net, why we have a fractured healthcare system, why we have no investment in public health, it all comes down to sort of the segregationist impulse. And, you know, Janine Interlandi, when she wrote her essay for the 1619 issue of the New York Times magazine, the reason we don't have national healthcare in the United States has everything to do with race. You know, the idea is that I'd rather go down to defeat by COVID then put a vaccine in my arm. Because, you know, if I have to think about the polis, I have to think of my community as an integrated multiracial community, that's a fate worse than death for some in the United States.
That also suggests that addressing it would require a really different set of arguments. I'm wondering if that's what's at the root of this, then, you know, are things like the New York City mandate what's going to move us in a different direction? Or this sounds terrible, but should we try to trick people that this isn't about mandates? Should we try to have a straightforward conversation about the ways that the polis is, in fact, more diverse?
Well, first of all, the federal mandate's been put on hold by courts, by a Trump-appointed judge in Louisiana. And so I assume Mayor de Blasio's vaccine mandate's going to be taken to court shortly. You know, the mandates have been remarkably effective in getting people vaccinated, even as they've been under scrutiny by some conservative courts and by conservative politicians. I don't know if we can trick people. I mean, my sense is that there are plenty of people in New York City, here in New Haven, where I live, who would like the vaccine but have complicated lives, and we need to get to them and get the vaccines into their arms. Trying to deal with this sort of cascade of misinformation and lies and naked appeals, or even if they're implicit appeals to race by Southern governors and other governors in the GOP, I don't know if we're going to be able to surmount that resistance. You know, the study that came out this week that suggested that voters in Trump counties were three times less likely to be vaccinated than those in Biden-leaning counties. It just shows that this isn't about the people there. It's about the politicians that represent them and frame the issues for them in a way that threatens their tribal identity if they dare show up at a vaccine clinic or put on a mask or take care of their neighbor in any way that makes any epidemiological sense.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study, and it's NPR was reporting on this. Our own Brian Lehrer was reporting on this yesterday. These data that are showing counties that were heavily Trump, in other words, 60% or more, are also taking the heaviest hits in terms of COVID deaths and are the most likely to be unvaccinated. And so that idea then that that in this case, right, you know, maybe you can opt out of public schools into, you know, Southern racial academies, and maybe you have the financial resources to opt out of public transportation into, individual cars, even if that's bad for the environment. But you can't actually opt out of an infectious disease. I'm wondering if that this deep partisan divide will in and of itself turn it around, like that as the unvaccinated are far more vulnerable to serious illness and death, that self-interest alone will be enough to push towards higher vaccination rates.
If we think about health disparities in many of these states that are chafing at vaccine mandates, they had terrible health disparities before the pandemic. There is an acceptance of mass death and suffering even before COVID-19. And yes, it fell hardest on communities of color, but states like Mississippi, Alabama have terrible health outcomes overall. I don't know if the pandemic, the epidemic among the unvaccinated, the sickness that we see in rolling waves in different parts of the country among the unvaccinated is going to be enough to do this. I don't fault Trump voters or Biden voters for the choices they're making. I fault the politicians who are, quote unquote, the trusted messengers who start to create doubt about vaccines, pit vaccination against core values like freedom and liberty, which people want to be all in for. 2 years, 3 years ago, we didn't have Republican politicians out there arguing against getting vaccinated from mumps, rubella, and measles. Now we're starting to see them veer in that direction as they start to think of all of public health as sort of a left-wing conspiracy.
What about the next pandemic or the next serious wave of this one? Is this kind of misinformation and partisan divide something that can be overcome?
I don't know, but I think, as you suggested, I think we have to talk seriously about our history of public health, healthcare, and how we take care of each other in this country, because it's really tied to our legacy of white supremacy, and it's really crafted how we respond to this pandemic. And unless we deal with these sort of root causes and fundamentals, the architecture of power in the U.S., we are going to be vulnerable, not just to the next pandemic, but the ravages of climate change and everything else that's going to come at us in this new century.
Public health correspondent for The Nation, Greg Gonsalves, is also an epidemiologist at Yale. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
We shift now to a part of the United States that has not had as much trouble convincing residents to get vaccinated for the public good. The island of Puerto Rico has one of the highest vaccination rates of any U.S. state or territory. It also has one of the lowest pandemic death rates. So, how did Puerto Rico become a bright spot in the pandemic? For more on this, I spoke with Nicole Narea, immigration reporter for Vox.
Yeah, so Puerto Rico is really a pandemic success story at this point. As of December 5th, it had fully vaccinated almost 75% of its population, and that's more than any other U.S. state or territory. And it's also had relatively low COVID death rates, about 102 per 100,000, and only a few states have lower death rates than that, including Hawaii, Utah, Vermont, and Maine. Cases peaked on the island around April when they were reporting more than 1,000 new cases per day, but that was also before the vaccine was widely available. And now cases are back down to about 146 daily. The island also hasn't shown the kind of spike in cases that other states have seen recently. And since the Omicron variant was identified, it's been battening down the hatches. Now even U.S. travelers who aren't fully vaccinated have to submit a negative COVID test within 72 hours of their flight. So at this point, there's really no reason to believe that Puerto Rico won't continue to weather this next phase of the pandemic well.
So let's talk about why. I mean, there'd be a lot of reasons to think that it would be quite the opposite story, right? That Puerto Rico is a place where, it's not one of the wealthiest American states, territories, locations, and it's obviously an island. And so when you're talking about an infectious disease, you could imagine that actually constraint in the context of an island could cause a higher caseload. And then finally, of course, it is still recovering from Hurricane Maria and from the variety of conditions that that causes. I'm wondering why they're doing better than places that are wealthier, have more space to get away from each other and aren't necessarily in a post-disaster context.
Yeah, and I would also say in terms of, you know, disadvantages going into the pandemic, Puerto Rico has a lot of medically underserved areas, and also almost half of Puerto Ricans are on Medicaid. So they're starting from a point where you wouldn't necessarily imagine that they would come out ahead here of most U.S. states and territories. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they are very well-versed in responding to public health crises. And, you know, I think it's right to go back to Hurricane Maria as sort of a focal point there in terms of the island developing a strategy to cope in times of disaster. So Hurricane Maria was really devastating to the island. It hit in 2017. There was extensive damage to the island's public health structure. You know, people didn't have access to clean drinking water and food. Hospitals and clinics were forced to close, and people with chronic illnesses had to travel really far to get the treatments that they needed. And, you know, as we know now, the government proved really incapable of addressing that crisis. So it was actually NGOs and community groups that really stepped up to fill the void there. And part of that was, you know, they set up emergency support centers, they helped clear routes to water sources and medical facilities and distributed basic supplies. And it was also the same story in 2019 when two major earthquakes hit the island. You know, the NGOs were the first responders. So by the time that COVID came around, these organizations were already very well versed in responding to public health crises, and they had established the kind of infrastructure and community relationships necessary for Puerto Ricans to really trust them with their health when it came to the pandemic.
All right, that language of trust, say a bit more on that and the ways that trust has made a difference in the vaccination rates.
Yeah, you know, it's not that, I think we have to talk about vaccine disinformation here, and it's not that it wasn't non-existent in Puerto Rico. You know, they were encountering the same kind of false stuff that was prevalent in the U.S., like that the vaccine would permanently alter their genes and that they were being injected with chips that would allow the U.S. government to track them. All of that was still prevalent in the media ecosystem there. But the government and public health authorities were just a lot better at responding to it and ensuring that it didn't hold the same weight. And part of that was that politicians across the spectrum and Puerto Rico didn't entertain and boost these conspiracy theories and allowed scientists to really lead the response. And there was a community that was accepting of that kind of messaging. And on the other hand, you know, I think it bears comparing to a state like Florida, especially because, you know, the largest Puerto Rican community on the mainland U.S. is in Florida. And Governor Ron DeSantis, you know, at the same time was holding press conferences with anti-vaxxers where, you know, he hadn't bothered to correct them on vaccine misinformation. But, you know, like the pro-vaccine messaging was also coming from every corner of Puerto Rican society. You know, there were Puerto Ricans who at one point were seeking a religious exemption to the vaccine, but then church leaders came out and said that they supported vaccination. So, you know, I think there was this rallying around this messaging and creating that kind of public trust such that, you know, between November 2020 and February 2021, the share of the island's population who wanted the vaccine went from 57% to 85%. And, you know, as of September, it was only about 79% of U.S. citizens overall who actually wanted the vaccine. So I think that really speaks to some of the groundwork that these organizations have been doing, not just during the pandemic, but for years, to really gain public trust.
It's also a fascinating sort of historical turnaround in a certain way, because if any place in the country would have an absolute right to believe that the U.S. federal government was experimenting on them or, you know, trying to put chips in them or something, like if any group might have a right to believe that, you could imagine it would be Puerto Ricans who had experienced, you know, the birth control trials, who had experienced the nuclear test trials. I mean, there is a living memory, a living history of nefarious action on the part of the federal government. So your point that these had to be pre-existing community-based relationships of trust in order to overcome that kind of recent history.
Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe that is a place where the U.S. might learn some lessons, because there has been similar histories of other groups facing the same kind of like medical experimentation in the US that might be similarly hesitant because of that history to take the vaccine. And I think that's really where the US needs to do some work to establish relationships in medically underserved communities and in communities of color, and ensuring that they have access to healthcare and public health resources.
Talk a little bit more about access. So you've told the story to us a bit around trust and around information and around even that sort of capacity to change minds in that November to January sweep. What about vaccine distribution? Were there particular tools or strategies used to simply make it accessible in a particular way?
Definitely. You know, I think part of the success of Puerto Rico's vaccination campaign can be attributed to the fact that they just made it extremely easy to get vaccinated. And that was really a joint effort across NGOs, with the Puerto Rico Department of Health, with the National Guard. You know, there was at least a dozen mass vaccination sites operating across the island for months. There's also a really high concentration of pharmacies on Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico literally has the highest concentration of Walgreens than any other place worldwide. And so I think they helped with distribution. But community health centers also played a large role. There's a huge segment of the population that really relies on those centers, which are funded by Medicaid, for their, you know, day-to-day primary care needs. So those centers already had existing relationships with the community, and they helped with administration. But there was also, you know, big NGOs. I spoke to one called Voces, which led large-scale vaccination events and even went door-to-door to vaccinate bedridden people in their homes and improve vaccination rates in communities with low uptake. So they definitely made vaccination easy. But we also can't really discount the fact that Puerto Rico also made it mandatory for a lot of people to get the vaccine. And I think that's perhaps where there's sort of the biggest difference with the mainland US, which just hasn't really been willing to go that far. Starting in July, Puerto Rico mandated vaccines for all students at private and public schools in order for them to start the school year in September. And they also made it mandatory for all public sector employees and people who work in service industries, such as salons, spas, gyms, and restaurants, like anywhere where you might have sort of some sort of interpersonal interaction or there's food and drink served. And then as of November, all private businesses with at least 50 employees have to require vaccination. So there's really not that many people who might not already be subject to those vaccine mandates. And I think just by virtue of making it mandatory, it really did improve uptake. But again, the US just hasn't been willing to go that far on the mainland.
That's fascinating. It's like you've given us a bit of a formula here, right? So build pre-existing trust, right? Battle disinformation in the moment, create accessible routes to the vaccine, and then mandate it. And boop, there you go. Yep. Vaccination rates enough to make a real difference. And I guess that's my very last question. So we know it's got these very high vaccination rates. What do we know about cases, hospitalizations, and deaths?
So at this point, like there's been really relatively low death rates, about 102 per 100,000. And as I mentioned before, only a few states have lower death rates, including Hawaii, Utah, Vermont, and Maine. Hospitalizations are still relatively low. And, at this point, you know, the public health infrastructure, you know, as inadequate as it might be at this point, and how that was sort of a weakness going into the pandemic, it's not overwhelmed in the way that we've seen in states where COVID cases were peaking. At this point, you know, Puerto Rico is in a good position for the next phase of the pandemic and probably will continue to be so.
Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Have you ever had an encounter with someone that left you feeling a little braver?
I remember getting in a car and just driving, and it was just for curiosity's sake. That freedom led to, like, a lot of rediscoveries. Just for life, things became colorful again.
Join me, Helga Davis, for conversations with artists and thinkers who share my passion for living fearlessly. It's a new season of Helga. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for sticking with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm going to take a minute and pass the mic to Representative Barbara Lee of California, who sent us this voice memo on our next topic. Congresswoman Lee, take it away.
You know, since the start of this pandemic, over 8 million people have fallen into poverty, which means more and more people are not able to afford diapers and other necessities. What's worse is most child care centers won't accept a child without a family supplying an adequate supply of diapers, which means that without them, families cannot work or pursue job opportunities. Low-income families with infants spend 14% of their income on diapers alone. Currently, there is no federal assistance for purchasing diapers, even though pre-pandemic, more than 5 million children under the age of 3 live in low-income families.
That's right, diapers. They are a fundamental need for every child for much of the first 2 to 3 years of life. But as you just heard from Representative Lee, many families struggle to afford them.
So 1 in 3 families experience diaper need. There's no assistance for diapers. WIC and food stamps do not cover them, and they cost up to $100 a month. So families are making really tough decisions between buying food or buying diapers. And every single time, they will choose to feed their children and try to make those diapers last as long as they can. So we're seeing babies left in one diaper a day, families rinsing out and reusing diapers, and parents making really tough decisions about basic need items that they shouldn't have to make.
Now that was Michelle Old, executive director of the North Carolina Diaper Bank, who joined my co-host Dorian Warren and me last year to talk about diaper need for an episode of System Check from The Nation magazine. I should also note that I sit on the advisory board of the North Carolina Diaper Bank. Now, we also asked you whether any of you ever struggled to pay for diapers and the effect that it's had on you and your family.
My name is Delia Smith. I'm calling from South San Francisco, California. My son is 41 now. I had him when I was 18. And yes, I did have trouble paying for diapers many, many times because it seemed that he would get diarrhea when I was short of funds. And it did have quite an impact because I would put things in the pawn shop and I would sell records to the used bookstore or sell books to the used bookstore in order to pay for diapers.
This is Renee from Arkansas. Yes, buying diapers really affected my family to the point where I couldn't eat so that I could have diapers for my child. And so, yes, it would put a strain on us financially. And I had to get another job actually to get out of it.
This is Nicole calling from Lamarck, Texas. The time frame when I was unable to provide diapers for my kids, I was going to local banks that give away diapers. And the Baby Stewart Foundation is a nonprofit organization in my area that really, really, really helped me out.
Hi, this is Melody in Richmond, Virginia. When our daughter was born in October of 2015, my partner and I really struggled to make ends meet. Diapers were a necessity, and we considered using cloth diapers, but couldn't really afford the additional time and effort. Each month, we went further into debt and just paying for the necessities with our credit cards. I was employed at a prestigious private university as an administrative assistant, and my partner was a maintenance supervisor for a large apartment community. We lived in a small two-bedroom, 760-square-foot house, and together our incomes couldn't meet all our needs. And so all in all, between the diapers and child care expenses, we've really struggled.
Thank you all for calling in and sharing your stories. We turn now to Chibeli Karazana, an economy reporter for The 19th. She recently wrote an article about diaper need in rural Missouri and explained to us just how far-reaching this issue is.
I think what's surprising when you start to learn about diaper need is exactly that, how far-reaching it is. 1 in 3 families will experience diaper need at some point with their children. And it is not something that is specifically only, you know, low-income families are facing this. No, middle-income families as well. Diapers are really expensive. I mean, about $100 a month, and the price has been going up since the pandemic began. And so it's this huge expense that is non-transferable. Think about food, for example. You can ration it, you can exchange with somebody, you can go to a food bank quite easily. Diapers are not like that. It's a diaper or a diaper, right? So there's really not a lot of options for parents. And that's where it becomes really, really difficult with diaper need, is just there aren't options. It's very expensive. And then you have this sort of third component where it's really highly stigmatized. Mm-hmm. So although it's very common, most folks are not willing to speak about it because they don't want to admit that they can't keep their children clean or dry. They don't want to say that this is something that is really expensive to them, that they're cutting corners, like Renee, the person who called in saying, you know, I'm eating less to be able to buy diapers. That's the reality for many folks. But for many, many, many years, it's been something that folks just, and still is something that folks just don't talk about.
Now, let's walk through a couple components of this, because when you talk about it being non-transferable, right, and you have to change diapers a certain number of times, and yet one of the heartbreaking aspects of your reporting is about how people, because they simply do not have the money to buy the pack of diapers, will in fact transfer, will have to make some pretty tough choices. What are some of the things you heard from parents?
Yeah. So for this story, we went out to Missouri, went out to the Ozarks, and went out with a local diaper bank to meet families that were getting diapers at these distributions at food banks. And one of the stories that really stuck with me was a mother in Missouri. Her name was Angela, who was there with her three-year-old. Her three-year-old was almost 100% potty trained. So she got a couple diapers for her, didn't know she could. I mean, the look on her face when they offered them to her of total relief. This woman has 5 kids, and at a point she had 3 of them in diapers. And so she talks about that period in time specifically being, she says, you know, diapers put me on my knees. I was begging for diapers. I was getting together all of my jewelry and pawning it. And she remembers exactly how much she got for that, $20. And she knows exactly what she got with that, a big pack of Love's diapers. She remembers going into a store and finding a cheap pack for $8, but she only had 5. So she begged and begged for that discount, and they just wouldn't give it to her. So at the times when she hasn't been able to get enough diapers, she's gotten a maxi pad and put it on little pink toddler panties and hoped that that would hold on. She's wrapped her children in towels. I mean, she's done what she must. And she's talked about it as something that has really rattled her conviction as a parent, as a mother, wondering, you know, am I good enough for these children? And that's something that we heard a lot. And we know that diaper need is a greater indicator of postpartum depression than food insecurity, than housing insecurity. I mean, it's really connected to all of these things, and really, really difficult for these parents when they can't afford it.
And of course, one of those reasons that it is even more connected than food insecurity and housing insecurity is because there are no, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's no federal government programs that cover these. So if you could talk a little bit about how the transition in the ending welfare as we know it to TANF, temporary aid to needy families, which meant fewer cash transfers, what that's meant for diaper need, why that's increased since so-called welfare reform.
So this is the big shocker, right? When I tell people about this, they immediately tell me, well, they can just buy it with SNAP, with food stamps, or they can buy it with WIC, which is a program for low-income mothers with children, right? You would think it would be a qualifying expense. It is not. Under both of those programs, they're not considered a nutritional product, so you can't buy them with either of those. And then, like you mentioned, once you know, we had welfare reform in the mid-1990s that eliminated a cash assistance program that many families were using for diapers. Instead, now we have TANF, but TANF is a program that less than a quarter of low-income families can access, and that access has been going down over time. And so what we saw happen in its place was the rise of these diaper banks in the early 2000s, which are like a food bank. They're nonprofits. They collect diapers and distribute them to families for free across the country. There's over 200 of them. And they're doing this work really with these tiny little staffs, I mean, servicing enormous, enormous areas to try to get at that need.
For full disclosure, I sit on the advisory board of the North Carolina Diaper Bank, and the need is stunning. It is it's jaw dropping, because these are, you know, basically operating as charitable nonprofit organizations. They also don't all have the same kind of rules about access. You know, some it's, you come to the diaper bank. Others, they, as you were showing in your reporting in Missouri, are actually partnering with places like food banks in order to find the families who have these needs. Again, based on your reporting and with the folks that you were talking with and working with, how is diaper need then connected to other kinds of poverty-based needs? What are diaper banks showing us about the world?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, like the bank I followed in Missouri, they do exactly what you said there. They partner with churches, with food banks, with all kinds of organizations in a 50,000 square mile area, an area the size of the state of Florida, essentially, to try to get diapers into these rural pockets of the country. And I think what it has shown us, I mean, diaper need is connected to all of these other needs as well, right? You have food insecurity that is particularly acute in this part of the country that we were in rural parts of the country. And so diaper need is connected to all of these things. So it's like a window into poverty and what it looks like.
I was also struck in your reporting about the research and the research showing, as you were alluding to earlier, the particular postpartum depression, stress, and sense of being an inadequate parent because of the inability to provide diapers. Can you say a bit more about what you heard from people as you were reporting out this story?
Yeah, the research is really interesting, particularly that piece that we talked about earlier about this being a higher indicator of postpartum depression, exactly for that reason. And I'll take you through some of the things that, you know, folks often tell me. And I think it's a little frustrating for parents because they also hear this as well, right? Well, why did you have kids if you can't afford the diapers, right? That's a big one. And sometimes I think we take sort of a middle-class lens on how we think about this, right? Like you go to school, you get a job, you get a house, and then when you're stable enough, then you have kids. Life is not that linear and that simple for folks. It's a lot more complicated, right? And so you have people that sort of move in and out of poverty. So the family that I was mentioning earlier, Angela, her family was doing okay when they had their kids, right? And then something happened. Her husband got sick. He lost his job. This was during the Great Recession. Then they got evicted. And so things piled up. And that is what sort of led them to really struggle with diaper need. And so it's really difficult for families because when they do speak up about diaper need, they're sort of cast aside. Well, why didn't you even have these kids? Well, these kids are already here, right? And they need the diapers now. And the other thing is, well, why don't you just use cloth? Which, you know, again, you know, cloth is a great option, but it's not for everybody. If you don't have a washer dryer, cloth becomes almost impossible, right? If you can't afford a $100 pack of diapers a month, you cannot afford cloth diapers. They cost much, much more on the onset to buy them. So there are a lot of reasons why cloth is difficult for folks. And if you're working, how are you cleaning those cloth diapers all day long, right? And if you want to put your kids in daycare, you know, some daycares will not accept cloth. So there's a lot of barriers, but this is what parents are hearing over and over and over again. Well, you should just, or you should just, or you should just.
I want you to say a little more about daycare to help us to understand the ways that so many of these families are working families. In fact, families where every adult in the household is working, and that diaper need is actually connected to that. I think, again, folks who may not have young children in childcare may not understand that diaper child care center connection.
Yeah, that's a big one. So when you go to put your child in a daycare, you need to provide all of the diapers they are going to need for the day. So that's 10, a dozen more diapers. You know, these families are struggling to get enough. Sometimes they're rationing diapers or trying to, you know, use fewer diapers during the day. And they might not have enough up front. That means you cannot put your child in childcare. Well, there was a study out of North Carolina, the bank that you know well, that found that 7% of diaper bank recipients of those parents were not going to work specifically because they did not have enough diapers to put their children in childcare and then go to work. And then when those families were provided the diapers, 15% said it allowed them to return to work or school. 18% said it allowed them to put their kids in childcare. So there's a big correlation there that is really important. We heard from some childcare centers that they were putting a Sharpie mark on a child's final diaper change of the day. And the next day, that same diaper was coming back, which means parents were not changing their kids just to make sure that they could put them in childcare. And so those two things are really important because it also hampers a parent's ability to go to work if they can't put their child in care.
What are the solutions? What are the policy proposals that are on the table? And given how long this has been a problem, why haven't we seen them move forward?
You know, I think there's a couple theories as to why. I mean, look, diapers are sort of a small expense in the grander scheme of the national budget, right? $200 million, it's what's been proposed. This year was actually a bit of a landmark year for diaper need. We saw a lot more attention to it, I think partially because of the pandemic. And we saw two bipartisan bills emerge, both of which would give about $200 million in aid to the diaper banks specifically for this work. And then a couple other stipulations that, you know, you could use diapers with a health savings account, a couple other things that you could do with them. And so that was the first time we saw bipartisan support for diapers. But like with many things, these things take time, right? And so nothing has really happened. Those have been proposed, they're sort of sitting there in the record, and nothing has moved forward. And I spoke to Representative Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, the head of the House Appropriations Committee, who was the first person to propose a bill on diaper need in 2011. And she also recently helped pass the child tax credit, which is something she had been advocating for like 20 years. And she talks about it similarly. You know, with the child tax credit, it wasn't that folks didn't want to support it. It was that there was indifference. They thought it was too small or just didn't want to focus on it. And with diaper need, it might be the same thing. It might just be indifference.
It's fascinating, your point that it's small dollars at the big federal government level, but it is it's huge in each individual family's budget. While we're waiting on public policy to make a change, did you hear anything from local banks, from the activists and nonprofit folks that you were reporting with about what they need?
I mean, they just need money. You know, they are cash absolutely strapped in the work that they are doing. I mean, the bank that I was working with has two paid staffers who are not getting paid very much to run this entire operation, 105 partners, I think, in 50 counties, 50,000 square miles, going out in their own van with diapers in the back to get these to folks. I mean, these are sort of grassroots operations that are happening across the country. And it's particularly difficult in these rural parts because, you know, you're driving these winding roads and it's hard to get there. So that's really what they want, is just to get a little bit more aid. And that's why these bills proposed were supportive of those. And then just more awareness. You know, I still think, you know, a lot of the time they're still telling people about diaper need for the very first time. Even the partners that they're working with forget to tell folks that they can get diapers at the food bank. So, you know, people are coming and they don't know that this is even something that's available to them. They don't know they can even ask for it. And that's still where we are. So stigmatized, so silent. That's what we talked about, it being sort of an invisible part of poverty in this country. It is so silent. And so their hope and my hope with the story at the 19th too, was just that people would understand that this is happening and people don't feel like they have even the ability to talk about it because they'll be, you know, talked down to and they won't be understood.
Chabeli Carazana is an economy reporter for the 19th, and she recently wrote an article about diaper need in rural Missouri. Thank you for joining us, Chabeli.
Thank you so much. So glad I could speak about this today.
My name is Lisa. I'm calling from Bradford, Pennsylvania. My daughter will be 39 in January, and 39 years ago, I had problems paying for diapers. My friends who with children had problems paying for diapers. We were all working. The price of diapers were outrageous 39 years ago. It's still outrageous for so many people not to be able to pay for diapers.
Hi, this is Kate from Pennsburg, Pennsylvania. It's been a while since I've had to buy diapers for our own household, but I do remember struggling to figure out how to pay for everything, how many I could buy on that week's budget. It really is a struggle, and I appreciate that now we're in a position where we can buy diapers and take them to a local food pantry.
This is Bonnie calling from Parker, Colorado. With diapers and my children, I was extraordinarily blessed that for my baby shower present, my father and stepmother provided diapers for the entirety of their need for our children. So that was an incredible gift for us and really helped our family get through those diapering years, which can be very expensive.
My name is Pam Stuckey, and I just wanted to mention the diaper bank. I hope that'll come up as part of the discussion. I know they've been an invaluable source of diapers for people in the Washington, D.C. area and its surroundings. So I hope that's available in other parts of the country, but they definitely help here.
My name is Tina, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. So our daughter is 9 years old, and so we remember almost a decade ago, when we found out we were pregnant, we would sit down and actually calculate per package and each diaper what it would cost us if we were to purchase it, say, at Costco or at a Safeway or a Target. And then if Target was going to do a special sale for you and you got $5 back or $10 or a $20 certificate, then you would break that down into the diapers and figure out how much it would cost. And I think on average, about 10 years ago, it was a quarter a diaper was the cheapest we were able to find. And of course, when you're on a budget, and if you're not a wealthier, privileged family, not only are you counting the diapers, but your children tend to stay in them longer. And there are studies that show this. So even diapers are a privilege, something to think about.
I never struggled to afford diapers. I made the decision before I had a child that I didn't want environmental damage to be lasting just from diapers, which are one of the worst environmental hazards. So I invested in cloth. It's an investment at first, but then you save hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and it's better for the child, and it's better for the environment. Petaluma, California, this is Larice Levine.
Marilyn LaMonica, calling from Somerville, South Carolina. My father was in hospice for about 2 years. He recently passed away, and working with a friend who was volunteering with hospice, she found that a lot of people were struggling to pay for adult diapers, which are extremely expensive. And Medicare only pays for, you know, about 100, I think it is. Don't quote me on that. However, because it's so expensive, I ended up donating the ones that were left over from my father to a younger hospice patient. It's just unbelievable to me that basic needs are not being met. And with the rise of inflation and things going up on a daily basis, it just seems like it keeps on getting worse. It's a vicious cycle.
In October of 2020, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy signed a law allowing for the early release of just over 5,000 incarcerated adults and juveniles. This was the state's effort to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 by reducing the prison population. Those eligible for release within a year were granted public health emergency credits for early release. Martin Fitzgerald was one of the first people released under this law.
All my emotions have been like up and down this whole time that I've been transitioning or reacclimating to society. It's still tough sometimes.
Governor Murphy, long a proponent of prison reform, nonetheless ended the health emergency status during the summer of 2021, which meant an end to early releases. With us to talk about decarceration in New Jersey is Karen Yee, reporter for WNYC Radio. Welcome, Karen.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So talk to us a bit about this law that Governor Murphy signed back in 2020 and the effect that it had.
This was an extraordinary experiment and sort of a moment in time where prison reform activists and folks that led reentry organizations got together and said, we need to do something, because New Jersey at the time and for several months actually had the highest COVID-19 death rate per capita. And you can't social distance in prison, right? So you had people getting really sick and dying. You had corrections officers also getting sick and dying. And so this bill was passed that was a first in the nation law to essentially look at the concept of good time off, like good time off for earned good time off for good behavior, and speed that up because of the pandemic. And basically anyone within a year of release could get out early. And what happened is more than 5,000 people got released, as you said, and the prison population in New Jersey was slashed by about 40% to levels that we haven't seen since the 1980s.
Now, that has long been a goal of many in the movement for decarceration, and it feels like New Jersey showed, oh, here's how you can do it.
Exactly right. And that's what some of the advocates were saying. You know, a lot of other states had tried to reduce population in different ways, through executive orders, releasing people who were really sick or past a certain age or nonviolent offenders. And New Jersey tried that too. Initially, the governor had signed several executive orders to release people who were medically fragile and met certain restrictions. But that became a really bureaucratic process. You had prosecutors and lawyers involved and organizers and lists of people and seeing who qualified and who was sick enough, right, or fragile enough to be released. And so what this did, this was a much more systemic automated process, right? It just basically looked at, for certain offenses, people who were convicted of murder, first-degree sexual assault, or repeat sexual offenders were not eligible. But everything else, it kind of looked at those charges, how much time you had left to serve, and then just sort of reduced your time if you were eligible. And so it took away that paperwork bureaucratic process that was slowing things down earlier when the state was trying to reduce people and get people out to keep them safe.
And is it at this moment by those lawmakers who made this decision pretty much seen as successful?
I think it depends on who you ask, right? If you ask prison reform activists and criminal justice reform activists, they see this as a huge win and as a huge model for how New Jersey can keep this up. Because, you know, like I mentioned, this is a moment in time. I spoke to Professor Todd Clear. He specializes in criminal justice at Rutgers University. And here's what he said.
It's a moment in time and it has gone away. And the prison population in New Jersey is now in the business of rebuilding itself. And if people like a smaller prison population, we have the tools to do that. Just make this law permanent.
So this law was tied specifically to the state's public health emergency. So people could get out early as long as there was a public health emergency in the state. So it's now over. The last person was released on October 4th. And so if we're talking about long-term impacts to the prison population in New Jersey, lawmakers have to go back and either remove that emergency provision or think of other ways to reduce the prison population. And that can be done, you know, depending on who goes into the prison, right? How long people are sentenced for and what judges are sentencing people for. So there's multiple ways to tackle this. This was sort of the bluntest instrument to do it quickly.
I want to also talk a little bit about the experience of folks who did experience early release. You know, it's one thing to decarcerate, to move folks out, but did the state also provide for supports to ensure that these were successful reentries?
That's a really great point, because reentry generally is difficult, not just in New Jersey, but across the country. And what lawmakers did in this case was they did pass another bill to try and provide more of those supports, because you are releasing more people than you normally would. You know, on an average day, I think it's about 8 to 10 people get released in New Jersey. And the first day of releases was the day after the election in November. And you had a bunch of people who had accrued these credits. So they were all released at the same time. So about 2,200 people across the state. And the state was supposed to provide additional supports. But because this was new, because it happened pretty quickly, a lot of folks were released without a state ID that the Motor Vehicle Commission promised to give out. And you need that ID to do anything. A lot of people didn't have a way to call their relatives, didn't know where to go, didn't have ways to get their prescription, anywhere to live. And so there were a lot of people that fell through the cracks. But this is what happens regularly. It just sort of happened in a concentrated fashion. Since then, the process has gotten better. And there were folks, we heard from Martin at the top, who did make it out and had family on the other side and was helped by the church and several organizations. And he's been able to find a job, get a car. He even took a vacation, really sort of reintegrating back into society. Not that it doesn't have its ups and downs and it's been difficult, but it's sort of been great to see the real life impact on him.
One of the things we often talk about when we're thinking about real life impact of having been incarcerated is the challenge with finding employment or having an educational opportunity. Can you talk to us about the Ban the Box bill?
Yes, this is another pretty significant measure the governor signed. And essentially, we know that affordable housing is hard, right? Generally, it's very difficult in New Jersey. And it's particularly difficult for people who are ex-offenders to find a decent and safe place to live. When you apply to rent an apartment on your application, you pay the application fee and they ask you if you have a criminal record. And usually that becomes an automatic disqualifier for people. So what this law does, and it takes effect next year, is it eliminates that box on the initial application. So a landlord can't automatically deny you for this. They can't do a background check until they tentatively accept you as a tenant. And so that means you're looking at other parts of your application and who you are, and then offering you that, and then they're allowed to do a background check. And even after they do a background check, there are certain provisions, right? You can, certain crimes, for example, murder, you know, they can reject you based on that. But for other crimes, there's a specific look back window. So the higher your offense, the longer that landlord can take that offense into account for a denial. And even when they deny you, they have to put it in writing and they have to give you a chance to appeal. So there's a built-in process to have more of a conversation. And then the other side of this law that I think is pretty significant is that there is an enforcement arm. Landlords can be fined up to $10,000 for violating it, and you can file a complaint to the Attorney General's office if you think that the landlord isn't following this process.
Karen Yee is a reporter for WNYC Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
All right, that's the show. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to leave you with a transformative takeaway. Shout out to the largest flying birds in North America, the California condors. Yes, the condors. Just stay with me for a second. Back in 1982, there were only 22 of these birds left on record. They were on the verge of extinction, caused by hunting, flying into power lines, consumption of human products like antifreeze. So, scientists made efforts to save the species, in part by taking them into a facility to manage their care. And the scientists made a database to monitor the DNA of the birds, to be sure they wouldn't mate close relatives with each other as the population grew. Then they realized that two of the birds were fatherless. Yes, listen here. Two of the birds contained DNA only matching a female, no male, making them the first birds to reproduce parthenogenically, meaning virgin origin. So how wild is this? Life truly found a way, as Dr. Ian Malcolm would say. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as of 2020, the California condor's numbers have grown to over 500. Keep up the good work, ladybirds, making that magic. And to the scientists keeping these beautiful birds alive, that's off to everybody. If you can think of anyone or any animal who deserves a transformative takeaway shout out, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.